So the first talk this afternoon is by Sam Downey on domestic abuse.
Yeah. So my name's Sam Downey. I'm talking about domestic abuse and virtual reality and how it's been used to train the police and being put to good use with police services in Aiden, Somerset and also Wiltshire Police. So these are just some of the clients I work with. So Apple, I've worked with Starbucks, had them redesign their website. I'm a reporter on BBC Click and also Channel 4 News. I'm also a technology reporter for the Twit TV network with Leo Laporte, which is in San Francisco, and also technology on Radio 2 occasionally. With Wikipedia, I helped to launch the world's first Wikipedia town called Monmouthpedia, and that's in Monmouth in Wales. And then I work with ITV Studios. I'm talent for them, whatever that means, but I think it means big on screen. And then I've also helped with Ustream. So Ustream is, as you might know, is a live webcasting platform. Initially, when they launched, I helped them to break it. So I was given a camera in San Francisco to go and cover some conferences, and they allowed me to walk around the conference and see what broke for their platform. And that's a really great experience. Of course, I've gone to Google's in San Francisco and Mountain View, and also Twitch is another webcasting platform. So I've got two URLs at the bottom of the screen, so keep an eye on those. So I've got mine on the left-hand side. I've also got another one on the right-hand side called Epilepsy Awareness Day, and I have epilepsy. So occasionally I get my brain wired up now and then to monitor my seizures, so you can see that in the photo. And I've got a rare epilepsy syndrome, which is called Dravet, it's a genetic form of epilepsy. So, as I've already mentioned, 20 years' work of working as a presenter and producer in radio, TV, voiceover, done some games as well, and some documentaries. I've worked in theatre as well, with the Bristol Olympic, so that's the world's oldest stage. Present items and technology on Click, and then website designer, and for quite a few charities, a beta tester for Twitter in 2007, and for other platforms, Ustream, which I mentioned, and I've worked with various venture capitalists in San Francisco and the Bay Area. And in the UK, I'm UK ambassador for this popular Epilepsy Awareness Day, which takes place taking over Disneyland in California every November. 3 days worth, and that attracts over 10,000 people to it. And so there's a URL for epilepsyawarenessday.org. And I'm also a skeptic, and I do skeptics in the pub talks in Bristol, Bath, Southwest, and also in London occasionally. And I'll be doing one fairly soon on scams. So, kind of look out for that. So, why an interest in 360 storytelling? Well, initially, it took me a while to get used to it. The format is engaging, creative, it's encapsulating and innovative. I've played games made in Unity. Unity is a platform for creating 3D games and videos. It's also free to download, so you can create various things by yourself, and then launch it online, and also using that same platform you can create games. So I bought a 360 camera and I started to take photos with it. I went to the Orkney Islands and I took photos of various parts of history, and as we know, the Orkney Islands is more famous than Stonehenge. So now I'm experimenting with editing 360 films using Final Cut Pro on a Mac and working on different projects. So I'm going to talk about one project today. So this talk I'm giving here at OpenTech is a talk which I gave last month, at the Virtual Reality World Congress, which took place in Bristol. And it's a really fantastic congress on everything about virtual reality, games, videos, and films. So the title of this is all about domestic abuse, about how you tell that and put that to storytelling. So I'm going to discuss in this talk who the client is. I'll talk about what the subject matter is briefly. I'll talk about why make it in 360, why remix it. It's a short film, I'll talk about briefly how it's made, how did I turn it into 360 VR, it's a bit of the creative process, and then I'll show you the final 2D edit. It's a 360 film, so that means you can actually go onto YouTube and watch the 360 version, but I've got the 2D version here for you. And there's debut here at OpenTech. So, first phrase which I thought about and came up with. So, if a 360 camera is a person, then who is that person supposed to be? This is kind of thinking about creativity and how you would go about storytelling with a 360 camera. Because that camera, you positioned it in a scene or a place, but of course the 360 camera will film everything that's around you. So you've got to remember, you're now putting a person in that place and into an experience. So this is the client. It's Gender-Free DV, who are based in Bristol. They've just set up as a charity. And so they're focusing on domestic abuse, and mostly on silent voices, on who these silent voices are. They are men, disabled people, children, deaf people, blind people, gay, bi, and transgender, because most of these people don't go to the police and report anything to do with domestic violence or abuse. And this came out of research, this is actual fact. So the question is, why don't we hear from people when they should be reporting these crimes? So the charity has come up with a couple of posters and research with some universities. And so these are kind of, these posters were to make an impact about gender-based violence. And it's been really great because we've had made an impact with a police force in the UK. And this is Avon and Somerset Police based in Bristol. And they created, working with them, we created a campaign called No Excuse, because there is kind of no excuse about abuse of all kinds. And we worked with them on creating images and some training videos as well for their police officers to learn and to recognise what abuse really is. So, meet Sean. He's a TV director and founder of Gender-Free TV. He's a person who comes up with films, and he has his own story to do with being abused as a child. So Sean gave me files. He made a film, and he gave me all the files. These files on my computer are all flat, so they're 2D films, basically. And he made it in a studio in Bristol. And he asked me, he said, how can I turn this into a 360 film to make it more interactive and to give the police a really better experience of what gender-free, of what domestic violence is? So I thought about it. And here's kind of the process. So if you haven't seen Final Cut before, if you can see it clearly on the screen, it's a platform which is costs about £300, and it gives you a timeline, gives you loads of plugins to edit a film. So remember, I'm making a 360 film that's flat in 2D, and this is the application which I use on my computer. So, first question. Now I've got all this video clips, so how the hell do I turn them to 360? This is how I went about it. So I've got the clips. I researched online. I found a really great plugin made in Hollywood by a film director called Tim Dashwood. And he created this really fantastic plugin. It was a few months ago costing £1,000. Now it's free to download, which is really fantastic. So I'm going to play you a short video about what this plugin really does.
Introducing Dashwood 360 VR Toolbox, offering real-time head-mounted display monitoring and a suite of utility plugins for Premiere Pro, After Effects, Motion, and Final Cut Pro on the Mac. The Dashwood 360 VR HMD Viewer app provides direct real-time playback to a head-mounted display while working on your 360-degree video in your favorite host app. The Oculus Rift DK2 is supported in the initial release, with support planned for other headsets coming to market in 2016. Dashwood's 360 VR toolbox includes a feature-rich set of tools for both 2D and 3D 360-degree video. The Reorient Sphere plugin filter allows reorientation of equal rectangular, lat-long footage on the X, Y, or Z axis. The Project 2D on Sphere plugin allows placement of 2D elements in a 360 spherical scene. This allows for placement of logos or other elements anywhere in the scene and can be used to obscure the nadir. The filter can also be used in After Effects with the Reorient Sphere plugin to paint out the 360 array's tripod. Seamless plugin filters are also provided for blurring, sharpening, glow, and noise reduction, without affecting the wraparound seams of the spherical scene. Cubic skybox and stereographic little planet projections are also possible with easy-to-use plugins. Project horizontal, upward, or downward-facing fisheye scenes into an equal rectangular panorama. Output keyframable pan and scan 2D or stereoscopic 3D versions of your sequence with the HMD Preview plugin. These are just a few of the features we have released so far, and we have many more on the way. The 360 VR Toolbox public beta can be downloaded now from within the FX Factory plugin store and used for free as a watermarked trial. Purchasing a license will remove the watermarks, and you will never be charged for future
I'll pause it there, because right now it's available for free, and this video was released in 2014. But anyway, so I downloaded the plugin, brought it into Final Cut, and this is kind of what it looks like when you're working with flat 2D video. You can place the video where you like, and remember, when you're working with 360 video, it's within a sphere, and the sphere is fixed. So it's kind of like putting your head within a beach ball, or a globe around your head. And this is so that acts as your projection screen around you. So this is kind of what that does. So you've got left, you've got right, you've got bottom, you've got top, and you've got front. And with this video, I was given a few simple elements to work with an actor and some subtitles and a logo as well. So I worked, it took me about a day or so to come up with an edit and think about where to position these elements using this plugin. So I had to go back and forth doing lots of A-Bing tests, making sure it looks really good. So on Final Cut, if I zoomed everything out, this is kind of what it looks like. So I've got my viewer on the right-hand side, and this is what the video looks like. On Final Cut, you can see there's loads of space around these video elements. And this is kind of the thing, because when you're working with 360 video, you're working on a huge size, which is equivalent to 4K video. So you're sticking a 4K visual template in front of your eyes. So you've got to think about resolution and different elements when you're working with 360. So, now you've learned a little bit about how we've affected the local police, and they've now commissioned a few more films to be made, because they think the 360 elements are really, really fantastic. So I'm now going to give you the London debut. I'm going to play you this video in 2D, and this is kind of what it looks like. First of all, let you know it's available on YouTube to view the 360 version. So if you search, go onto YouTube, search for gender-free DV, and you'll see the 360 video listed. So, Without further ado, here's the 2D version of the film.
Domestic violence doesn't just happen to women. Gender Free TV, a Bristol-based charity, working for those silent voices affected by domestic violence and abuse. Join us. Find us online at www.genderfreetv.co.uk. Thank you.
So there you go. That film was all based on true fact. And very well researched, and this is something which doesn't get comes up in police stations when police are talking to deaf people, and especially well men and also women who are transgendered too. So, final reminder: if you want to see this video in 360, and if you've got a phone and a 360 viewer. Then go online to YouTube and search for Gender Free TV. So, and so this is the charity in Bristol. If you want to find out more information, then get in contact with them. And if you want to get more notes about what I've talked to today, and also it's got all the links to the videos, then find me on Medium. So medium.com/@Sam Downey. And these are the notes from my VR conference notes from last month, and that's all the information about me. So, thank you.
Okay. Do we have any questions?
So, carrying on the theme of 360, I think, here.
grant making. Yes, 360 giving. So,
give it a moment.
Okay. We should say, those of you right at the back, I know the screen isn't too good at that distance. There are lots of seats further forward if you need to see it better. Okay, over to you, Catherine.
Hi, I'm Catherine Jolan from 360 Giving, and I'm going to talk about our work opening up UK grant making. So we're a charity, we're relatively new, we were founded in 2015, and we've got a sort of one mission. And that's supporting grant-making organisations to publish their data openly, and then also working with people to understand the data and use it. And we want to do this because we think having this information available will lead to more innovative, informed approach to grant-making for those who make funding decisions, but also those who are looking for funding. So within this, we've got three goals. We support the organisation to publish their data openly, and I'll talk a bit about that. That's technical support and other science kinds of practical support. Then also we're working to help people understand how to use the data. This is all in order to stimulate the building of new tools and analysis of this new data set. So we have a pro bono model. We're a charity, we're funded by grants ourselves, and so all the support we provide to grant makers is freely available. We're not a consultancy. We work with any kind of organisation that gives grants, so we're talking about grant making trusts and foundations, lottery funders, central and local government, so any entity that's giving grants, and by that we mean sort of non-returnable finance. So we're not talking about social finance in that, but there is this level of things that are happening in local authorities like contracting, which we think is similar enough to grant making to be covered in that. Like I said, why it matters and why we're trying to tackle this is that the UK grant making and funding environment is very complex. This slide shows, it's from a report called Giving Trends, which tracks the top grant-making foundations in the UK. And there's a flow of £6 billion going into various grant-making charities. And these are just the charities, so that this doesn't cover the governmental and local authority giving. But all these organisations are giving to civil society of various kinds, backing the same places and themes and organisations. But it's very difficult for the grant makers themselves and those looking for funding to get a clear understanding of who's giving what, with what impact. It's time consuming to find the information. So we think this could be done more effectively, more openly. This information should be more available. It could be easier to map these flows if we can provide the data about who's giving these grants in a standardised way. We think this is a kind of simple idea for dealing with this complexity. This is what we kind of, the aim is, the equivalent of a Google for finding out who has funded what, where, when. You know, a one-stop place where both those giving grants and also the charities that are looking to receive funding can get accurate and useful information to make fund-seeking and fund grant-making more effective. We're not at this point yet. This is just a prototype map with some data that we've made available. But essentially, we're looking towards this as our aim. What we have done is built a tool called GrantNav. So this is a tool that makes it possible to explore the data that's already been published. We're very proud of this. We launched it in September 2016, I'll just give you a URL to it. And before then, it wasn't possible to search for open comparable data on where grants were going. And now it is available. And as each new organisation comes involved in our initiative, more data is available and the data gets richer. So to build the kind of tools like the kind of imagined map, but also our tool GrantNav, it's not just open data that you need. We think it needs to be standardised so that you're comparing apples and apples and so that you can build the kind of technology that you need. So, you know, the plug analogy is the one. You need an adapter in order to plug in when you go abroad. we know that lots of grant-making organisations actually do share information about what they're funding, but it's on their websites in lists, it's in PDFs, it's locked away in accounts, and it's spread around in different websites, and it's very difficult to access, and it's also very then difficult to bring together and make sense of. So our idea is that we help organisations to plug in by using a standard. It saves the time and the manipulation, and then it'll be more time spent on the analysis and understanding. So this is really what's at the heart of our mission. It's helping organisations that give grants to adopt a standard way of sharing their information to make it more usable and useful to others. So in terms of the standard itself, it's actually quite complex. There's scope for talking about a great range of the activities around a grant, but we have created it so that there's 10 items that are mandatory, and then people can build from that. So it is, broadly speaking, you know, who gave the money, how much was it, when did they make the award, and what was it for, and who did they give it to? And those 10 items are enough, we think, to say something useful about a grant. And then also you can build on that. Talking about where was the recipient organisation located, and where were the beneficiaries located. So these are all things that we find most organisations we're involved in have the scope to publish information on. And then obviously the more you can add, the more you can share, the more powerful it is. But we always start by talking to organisations who may have very low tech capacity and low data literacy, that, you know, you start where you can, publish what you can, and then add more at your own pace, and we find that that's the kind of right way to approach organisations who aren't used to thinking in terms of data. So, you know, once you've got the 10 core items, you can talk about the web address, you can use classifications, talk about programmes. So it's something that people build on and learn from, and, you know, we've seen organisations starting by publishing in one first time, and then learning that they can make it more useful and publishing more as they go about, as they kind of progress. So... so far we've got 34 organisations that have published data in this way. Like very large organisations like the Big Lottery Fund has shared all of its grant making for the last 10 years in this open data standard. Also big national funders like Comic Relief, Beauty of Children in Need, organisations like Nesta, but there's also Trafford Council, we've got the City of London, and a range of smaller organisations as well. So, you know, we have a target to try and get 80% of grant making published in this way by 2020, which is quite an ambitious goal. So we're starting with contacting all the large organisations first, because they've got the greatest amount of data. But we're working with also very small organisations. A council for voluntary service in Manchester called MAC, they give out grants, and they're publishing as well. We're working with the community foundations, because we know, although they might be not large grant makers, they're giving really interesting kind of grants to grassroots community organisations in a local place, and people really care about where that money's going and want to know what's available to them. So yes, there's 34 funders. We've got over 200,000 grants published in this way. They're all collectively worth £8 billion, actually £8.8 billion now. Our model is working with individual funders, making their data available on their websites. So this is still spread around, and people have ownership of it, but we've also built a registry that leads people to discover where the data is, so that you can go to our website and you can see the whole list of the organisations publishing and access their files to support people who want to use the data. So a lot of our work is involved. Yeah, a lot of our work is involved in sort of supporting these organisations get on board. This is a big part of a startup, but this coming year we're also starting data use pilots. So we're starting in Greater Manchester, working with local funding organisations to try and get them on board and look at what the data can say about funding flows in Greater Manchester. We'll also want to be looking at themes and other kinds of things. So another thing that we've really focused on is making sure that it's really good data. So we've built tools that allow organisations doing this to test that the data is valid and converts. So we allow people to publish using a spreadsheet, But the standard itself is in JSON, and so we have a tool that allows you to take the Excel spreadsheet that you've published in, convert it to JSON, but also check that it's valid, you know, that you've got all the right date formats, and then also gives further feedback about how your data could be more useful, so suggesting that you include geographical codes. So, you know, this is something we're working on with people, trying to make it as easy as possible for them to do it. We also support developers who want to use the data. So, like I said, the schema itself is in JSON. We have all the files. We have the data registry. And the standard itself was derived from schema.org and was based on the IATI International Data Transparency Initiative, Open Data Standard, and Open Contracting Data Standard. We work with Open Data Services, who were the organisation that helped establish those standards. So we're trying to maintain a kind of best practice in terms of mapping with other standards, using building blocks that other organisations and other standards are using. So the JSON schema that is the kind of fundamental standard is an open source schema. It's available to fork on GitHub. And we support multiple file formats, so you can publish in plain text, CSV, Excel, and also JSON. So our developers, our Open Data Services Cooperative, and so you know, with them we support developers to get machine readable access to this data through the registry. And we're really keen for people to use it, tell us what works, tell us what doesn't work, you know, kind of connect with us about what could be made more useful about it. So we've already got people using the data. We've got research organisations who are interested in, you know, statistics around the voluntary sector, like NCVO in England and NICVA in Northern Ireland using it. We've got fundraising organisations use it. And we're supporting a platform called Beehive, which is basically using the open data to create profiles of funders, then to make matches with charities. So it's a bit like a matchmaking service in the sense that it's sort of a charity says what it's looking for, and it uses the underlying open data to along with other data sets in order to say, you're a good match, this is a funder that you're likely to be able to progress an application with. So we've also getting people using the data, because it's out there and openly available. Sort of open data initiatives. Open Data Manchester did a sort of hack with it, and it's very difficult to see, but this is basically trends in grant making threshold. So different national funders and the point at which their grants are, you know, different. So that's 5,000, 10,000, 100,000, a million. You can see the sort of steps in which their thresholds and their grants are. So there's quite a nice blog post with analysis of what they did there. Bath Hacked, which is covers Bath and East Somerset, we're doing a mapping sort of days before Christmas and took the data from GrantNav, did a map of their area. These are things that we don't necessarily know about before they've happened, but we're really excited when we see that people start to use the data, because it means that it's useful and it's sort of exciting people, and we want more to do it and come and tell us how they've used it and when it does and doesn't work. Like I said, we built this tool, GrantNav, ourselves. This is for people to explore the data. It means people with no technical knowledge can start to look at it. You know, some people are motivated by JSON, some people by spreadsheets. Lots of people are just interested in, you know, how does it help me? We found it's a really useful advocacy tool as well for engaging with organisations to get them to publish. Because before, when we were just talking about spreadsheets, people would phase out. But when you can show them a tool and show that if you search for an applicant, if you search for a place, you can see who else is funding in an area that you're interested in. You can see who else has funded the same organisation that you have or that you might be interested in. It's allowed us to show when quality matters and when kind of being comprehensive and caring about things like organisation identifiers matters. So it's been really useful for us and powerful for shedding a light on what's going on, showing the connections between organisations, causes, places that people want to find. And we find groups of funders are now using this data alongside their internal data to kind of find out what's going on in their local area. If you go on there, GrantNav, you can search by keyword, you can filter by geography, amount, year, all those kind of things. And at any point you can download the data. So it's not the kind of the full schema of data, but it has been enhanced by grant now to include some more geographical data, but it's a useful data set for sort of retail use of the data that's there. So, you know, please go and try it and, you know, let us know what you think. For instance, you could definitely put a search for domestic violence in there, find out who'd funded domestic violence, where they are, the kinds of organisations involved. You know, it's got a powerful search in terms of looking for things. And yeah, so GrantNav itself is open source software. and it was developed by Open Data Services for us. So when the GrantNav tool, it gets the data as a CSV, it uses Flatten tool to convert it into JSON, because we have no publishers who are publishing straight to JSON at the moment, although we're hoping some will come online this year. And yes, so once it's converted, I've got the technical stuff here. What happens? Sorry. Once it's converted, there's a script to load the data into Elasticsearch. So that's one of the things it's based on. So it uses an unmodified version of Elasticsearch. It uses a lot of that search functionality for the facets. So when you go into GrantNav, you can look by a place, you can look by organisations, and by funders, and it's using that search functionality, and also for giving results. Now, Django's used to render the pages and to serve for the main pages of the website. So GrantNav is in the database. It uses Elasticsearch to use the data directly, and a themed version is Bootstrap is used for the front-end CSS, and data tables are used for some of the tables and results. So these are kind of underlying stuff. But if you go to the GitHub page for GrantNav, you can see all the code, see all the detail, and also if you go to GrantNav itself, it's got a page for developers, for people who are interested in that. So, you know, please go and check it out and comment and let us know what you think. So if you want to find out more, we've got a website, go to GrantNav, please do use it, look. We've got the data quality tool, if you're preparing data, if you're a grant maker, go to GitHub. And also, we're part of an initiative with other data standards called identify.org, which is looking to create a list of organisational identifiers. So if you're interested in identifying organisations, if that's a problem that you have, to come and talk to us. We're trying to help solve the how do you identify a church, a school, a government body in Canada, all those other kind of things.
Hello everyone, my name's Kaylee, I'm from Outlandish, and I don't have any slides, I will just openly admit it now. I locked myself out of Google Drive last night when I was going to do them, and I just got access today. But, you know, it is what it is. But I've got a lovely website showing instead. Plus, my slides usually rubbish, so it's no big loss. Okay, so I'm from Outlandish. We are a tech worker co-op based in Finsbury Park. We have worked with Beehive that you mentioned. We helped part fund their project. If you came here by a bicycle and you looked up directions on Cycle Streets, which was on the Open Tech website, we also helped fund that. So, you know, we're in good company. And I am here to talk about co-tech, or cooperative technologists, if you want to say all of the syllables, which is a network of digital co-ops based in the UK. So, at the moment, the website isn't quite up to date because we've had two new co-ops this week join. So we're now 25 co-ops in the network. We kept it broad by calling out specifying digital co-ops, because it's intentional that way, so it's inclusive. That means that we've got a range of people involved, a range of co-ops. This is going to be annoying to scroll. Okay. So we've got people like Blake House, who produce videos and work mostly with people in the cooperative network. Founders and Coders, who are a coding school, and Media Co-op, who also produce videos and are based in Scotland. So basically everybody in the network uses digital tools to deliver their product. The main reason for the network was that all of the people that you see on this screen have broadly the same aim. However, a lot of us, well, some of us had too much work and some of us did not have enough work, which meant that unfortunately work was leaving the cooperative sector, which is not good if you're a co-op. So we decided to help start a network in order for more of us to stay in touch. Also, we had frequently been in the position where we had to turn down work at Outlandish because we just couldn't deliver it in time. So it's great if we can pass it on to a different network, onto a different cooperative in the network. There are other things such as we get paid quite well at Outlandish. Some of the other cooperatives don't pay themselves very well because they can't. So we hope to, in the long run, help support that and raise the wages. It's worth saying what a worker cooperative is, because a lot of the time when I tell people that I work for a co-op, they think I work for the supermarket, and I don't. So a worker co-op means that essentially the workers own the business, which is brilliant because you don't have a cheeky CEO sitting in a nice office earning loads of cash off of your hard work. The owners are called members, and everybody's vote is equal. This is really, really important to us because it's kind of an open pledge that you are not exploiting the workers. And we have 7 cooperative principles that every cooperative kind of signs up to. One of those is collaboration over competition, which is extremely important and also goes well with the network. There are about 450 worker co-ops in the UK. There's a range of sectors. There aren't that many digital co-ops in comparison to the others. A lot of agricultural food co-ops, but there's also co-ops that do stuff like build medical instruments, and they're a worker co-op, which is brilliant. So there aren't really any limits in terms of what a worker co-op can or can't do. Sorry, when I turn my page. Okay, so I'm going to talk a bit about how and why we started the network. I get asked a lot, like, how do you start a network? And I'm like, well, you need to find people, first of all. That's usually a good first port of call. Then you need to tell them what you're up to and ask them if they want to get involved. Hopefully they like the idea and they want to talk to you, and hopefully they want to meet you in person, because that is key to starting a network. Some people didn't want to join when we first contacted them. The way we did this was Harry in the Black Hoodie Googled worker co-ops in the UK, Googled tech worker co-ops, and then phoned them and said, we're starting a network, do you want to get involved? Some people were like, yeah, it sounds brilliant. For others, it wasn't quite tangible enough for them because we didn't really have any outcomes. We just wanted to start it and we wanted to get it going. And we also didn't want to own it. So we were reluctant to say, this is what we're going to do and this is not what we're going to do. There was one man who didn't want to share his email address with anyone, so that was a bit of a blocker. But, you know, at least we called him because we're nice and inclusive. So we put in a deposit for the only worker-owned stately home in the UK called Whiteley Hall, which is in Sheffield. And that was quite early last year, probably around February, March time. And then we kind of forgot about it because we had so much work to deliver. And then it kind of got to late August, and we were like, oh, yeah, sugar, that event that we need to run in order to start this network, we better get on it. And it all went from there, really. There were lots of questions from people that we phoned and people who said they wanted to come. Most of them were, what are we going to talk about for the 3 days that we're going to be there? What are we going to do in general? And what are the outcomes going to be? And every time anybody asked me that, I said, I don't know, I have no idea. Because it was a collective, event, and it wasn't for anybody to specify what we were going to do. More importantly, we had to establish trust, which is one of the key elements of any well-functioning network. So the first thing that we had to do was get in a room and meet each other and spend 3 days and hopefully want to collaborate after those 3 days and not drive each other crazy. We didn't do that, and it was actually really good. So it was brilliant, actually. Some tickets were sponsored for cooperatives who were not able to pay the full whack, which is fine because not everybody can. We spent the first half day learning how to facilitate. We had a sign for mansplaining. We all know that the tech sector is dominated by men. It is what it is. And we want to try and kind of do what we can as a cooperative and as a network as much as possible. So we tried to we clarified it straight away. If you're mansplaining, you're going to get a bit of this. Luckily, I didn't actually see any of this in any of the sessions I was in, so it worked out well. We worked with open spaces, with sessions that were curated by us. So it was clear from the start that nobody was going to lead, either at the event or further down the line. And we formed a network. We also named it, which is Cooperative Technologists, but I prefer Cotech because it's just a bit long. So 6 months later, what are we achieving today? We've got a ton of clients. I can keep scrolling. But I can also leave you to have a look at the website yourself, which is coops.tech. So we have 25 digital co-ops across the UK. We have collaborated at least 10 times across the network. We have shared skills, we've shared advice, we've shared spaces, we've shared drinks. It's been brilliant so far, and it's gaining more traction. We've met up a few times, we've built this lovely website, and we've got a shared revenue of over £5 million, which is brilliant. We also started winning work that we probably wouldn't have been able to win before. So recently, it was kind of, in all honesty, a bit of an experiment to do a collaborative pitch for some work for UNICEF. We did it with Agile Collective, who are based in Oxford, and we were like, okay, let's try and pitch this work, see how it goes, and try and learn so that in future we win the work. But we won the work. And we were like, oh, okay, brilliant, we won the work. And UNICEF's feedback was that part of the reason why we won it is because they really, really like this collaboration across two different worker co-ops based in two different parts of the country. So the crux of it is that the collaboration is gaining us more business, which is brilliant if you want to look at it. I'm already a believer in collaboration, but if you're the kind of person that needs to be persuaded, then if that's not going to persuade you, I don't know what will. We don't have any rules or expectations, but we do have a loose agreement that work that we collaborate on will somehow fund social value further along. There are a few things that we haven't sorted yet. We're working towards doing a quality framework together. We also want to kind of establish this idea of more of surplus being used towards social value or investment, but we are also having a meetup later on this year where we hope to get in the room and sort these things out in person. There is no one person that leads from any co-op. People send emails to our contact list and anybody replies. It works really well. So why am I here? I am here to tell the good people in this room of this network that there is a fully functioning network in your sector. If you want to get involved, we would love you to become part of it, but there is a caveat that you should be a cooperative. I would prefer if you're a worker co-op, but that's a purely personal preference. I also want to show that we're helping, sorry, I can't even read my own writing, which shows how quickly I scribble all this down. We are facilitating a redistribution of knowledge, and we're giving more tech to people that can't necessarily afford it, which we think is extremely important. We're doing this in terms of the social value work that we want to, in the long term, produce more of as a network. One way of doing this is to collaborate rather than compete. So, I think if you know somebody who's doing something very similar to what you're doing as an organisation, you really have a duty to call those people or that organisation and say, hey, we do the same thing as you do. How do you do it? Because we would like to find out. You might even start a network, which would be brilliant. But the crux of it is that if you care about your sector and you want to make a positive impact in it, collaboration will ultimately make it more positive and make it work better. That's my my speech over. I just wanted to let you know that there is also a public-facing forum called community.coops.tech. This is on Discourse, now it's open source, and you can get involved and have a look at what we're talking about. There are a couple of really good conversations at the moment, other than Pizza Afternoon on the 20th, which is stuff like what we're working on as individual co-ops on election work, which has been moving very, very quickly, but we just want to know what each other are doing and if we can help support each other and also communicate more about it in an outward-facing way. So we've got this, we've got coops.tech, which is the website, we've got contact at coops.tech if you want to get in touch and say hi or say, hey, I want to join, or how do I become a co-op so that I can join the network. We are also meeting at Wortley Hall, the worker-owned stately home, on the 27th of November, if you're interested. And there is soon to be a cooperative space opening at Finsbury Park underneath our offices. So if you're involved in that and you want a desk, get in touch and we can try and sort you out. I've also left some beautifully designed propaganda on two chairs next to the door, which you're very welcome to take home with you and tell people about this digital cooperative network that is doing good things. Thank you.